What is your worldview? Over the past few weeks, I have pounded you with statistics about this thing that we call worldview. All of them pointed to a disconnect in what we say we believe and how we actually live our lives. None of them shined a positive light on how we, the church, view our world. And this week, I have a few more telling statistics to share with you, but they're not from the survey that I've been using. They are from reality. Fact. 100% of people have sinned. Not one here. There's none righteous. No, not one. And Rich talked about the Noah thing and how 8 people were saved. Well, you do understand Noah was saved in the ark because he didn't drown, but Noah's not here anymore. You know how I know that? Because the Bible says Noah died. And 100% of people someday will die. I know that sounds kind of depressing, but it's a fact. Life has an expiration date. All life does. And there's another fact that a lot of times we don't like to deal with, and that is 100% of people that die without a relationship with Jesus will spend eternity separated from God. That's a fact. It's not something there that we debate. There are no exceptions to these rules. It's 100%. Our Big Blue Marble series is ending, and it's easy to get overwhelmed at the world when we begin to think about 100%. I mean, there are billions of people in this world. So I tell you what, let's just step back for a moment and let's talk about our world just for a moment. So, the city of Stanton, that is where you are right now, is 19.9 square miles. Its current population, at least as of the last census, is 25,385 people. That's still a lot of people. It's a lot of territory. But you know what that means? With just simple math, that means that each square mile, there is an average of 1,275 people in Stanton, Virginia. And according to the census, 47.4% of people in Stanton say they are religious. That breaks down to 38.9% claim Christianity as their faith, 6.9% claim Protestant Christianity as their faith, 6.9% claim Catholicism, 0.3% claim Judaism, and 1.3% claim something else. But they're still religious. So if I just do basic math, 54.2% of people living in Stanton claim no faith at all or a faith that is unconnected to Jesus. It's just math. So that means within 1 square mile of 33 Churchville Avenue, Stanton, Virginia, which is where you are currently sitting, there are 691 people that are what the Bible would call lost. 1 square mile. So that means I can walk 1 mile in every direction here and make myself a big circle. And as I'm walking that circle, that means inside that circle, there are 691 people that need a relationship with Jesus. We don't have to go very far to have a world view, do we? Our world is right in front of us. 691 people. Where would we put 691 people if we got them? Okay, we need a bigger building. We need a bigger ark, right? But you understand, they're right here. They're right here in our view. 691 people. We could do that, right? We could walk 1 square mile, right? I bike about 10 miles a night. 1 square mile isn't that much. We could do this, right? Yes and no. That totally depends on how we view our world. I'd like to start this morning by asking, how did Jesus see the world? We can go to Matthew chapter 9, verse 36, and we see, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. We can go to Matthew chapter 14, verse 14, and it says, when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. We can go to Matthew chapter 15, verse 32. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have had nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry or make them collapse on their way. We can go to Matthew chapter 20, verse 34. Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. And immediately they received their sight and followed him. You see it, right? How did Jesus view the world? Not with judgment, not with rhetoric, not even with really good Bible teaching, because the Bible wasn't there as far as the New Testament is concerned. How, when Jesus looked out and he saw the world, what's the word? Compassion. Compassion. Jesus saw them. He didn't just walk by them and say, okay. He actually stopped and looked at the people and he saw them for who they were, for what they were, for what they believed, for how they were living. He saw them and he had compassion. He healed them. He healed them. He restored sight and he healed the lame and he caused the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. It says that Jesus had such compassion on them, he healed them. It says he fed them. Talk about a fellowship supper, 5,000 men plus women and children. And it says he fed them. And here's the one that maybe blows your mind that you never thought about. Jesus touched them. It was not a hands-off ministry. It wasn't that Jesus looked at them and said, go in peace, have a good day. It says that when Jesus came to these people and he saw them, it says he reached out and he laid his hands on, he touched them. He allowed the little children to come and climb all over him. Jesus touched them. It was an interactive ministry. When Jesus saw them, he called them, folks. Matthew chapter 8, verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. He called them. He looked right at them and said, if you want me, if you want a relationship with me, I am willing, open, ready, available. I see you. All you have to do is be willing to come and be a follower. When Jesus saw the world, he did not build a bridge to them. He became the bridge for them. That's important to note. There's a difference in that philosophy. Now, how did Jesus become that bridge? Well, it's really simple. He stretched out his arms on the cross and he gave his life for them. That's who Jesus is. You know what the next question is, right? So how do you view your world? Ask yourself these questions. Do you see them? We got our name, Parkview Christian Church, and it was actually named from a little girl's actions. Her name was Vanessa. And when I first came here, she was a little tyke, and she's now all grown up. And every Sunday morning, she used to come straight in this building and walk through here, and she'd stand right at that glass door, looking out that glass door. And when you ask her what she's looking at, you know what she would say? All the people in the park. She just kept looking at the people because she saw people. Are you willing to connect to their lives so that they can be healed? We have a lot of disease in our world and a lot of things that people are struggling with, but you do understand the most terminal disease we have is sin. It affects all of us, and someday it's going to be the death of all of us. But here's the good news. We know the cure for that, right? His name is Jesus. But for me to be able to share that cure with the world, then you understand, I can't just walk up and say, do you know Jesus? You can't do it that way. I actually have to take a moment and connect my life to theirs and let them know that I'm just not some crazy person walking around with a bullhorn. I am here because I actually care about your life. Would you feed them? Their physical needs, all those things that go in their life, that's expensive work here, folks. We've been running our blessing box for years now. Do you know how many hundreds of pounds of food that have gone through that box for people that just need to be physically fed? Would you be willing to do that? Here's the one. Would you sacrifice yourself so that they could find Jesus? I don't know about that. I mean, the sacrifice thing isn't something we're really good at. Here's the important question. Would you be willing to become their bridge? When I originally wrote this, this sermon was going to be called Building a Bridge to the World. And after doing some thought, I decided that's not what we want to do. We have to become the bridge to the world. I'm in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11, and we're going to pretty much stay right here today. It's a little small verse. This is one of those little things. We're going to dissect it and look at it. This is what Peter writes us. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires, which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us. So, where's your home? I have a house, and when I finish my day here today, I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to drive to what I now call home. It's not the first house we've owned. We've owned a couple. It's not the first place I've lived. I've lived in a bunch of places. I used to have this lady that was kind of a mentor to my wife, and she used to have a sign that hung on her wall that I loved. It said, home is where you hang your memories. Home. Where's your home? We pitched a tent here about a month or so ago, and we had the understanding that this is not our home. And Peter starts off kind of backing this up because he gives us a couple of terms that we need to embrace. A foreigner. It's a person born in coming from a country other than one's own. So when you're here in this world, do you believe yourself to be a foreigner? Now, some people actually believe that I actually may be from another planet, you know. I don't have a hard time convincing people that. That can be a little strange at times. But I don't usually view myself as a foreigner. I mean, this is where I was born. I was born on this planet. I was born in this country. I was born in this state. I wasn't born in this city. We moved from Lynchburg, Virginia, is where we started out. But I don't usually count myself a foreigner, but Peter says I have to. And he also says, I have to count myself an exile. The state or period of forced absence from one's own country or home. So that means there's somewhere else that I'm supposed to be, that I want to be, but something's standing between me and them, me and that point, and I can't get there. And Peter says, you have to embrace this idea that when you look at your worldview, you have to consider yourself a foreigner and an exile. Now, unfortunately, we do this sometimes, and it makes us very standoffish. Because it makes an us and them. Those people, we like that term. Them people that are not, we can fill in the blank. And we draw the lines. And well, this concept of being a foreigner in exile and the worldview scriptures that we've been studying over the past few weeks, it was actually mentioned directly in 3 and kind of hinted at in the other one. Remember in John chapter 17, what did Jesus say? They are not of this world, even as I am not of it. So, this isn't where you were meant to be. I am quite sure you remember this particular verse. This is the one from Philippians chapter 3, verse 18 through 20, where Paul says, we are citizens of heaven, so who do we pledge our allegiance to? Am I a citizen of heaven or am I a citizen of this world? Peter, of course, says foreigners and exiles. And then 1 John, we are told we cannot that the world cannot be the focal point of our love. So while I am commanded to love the world, I am told I can't fall in love with the world. There's a huge difference. And I think a lot of times I don't love the world enough, but man, I sure am in love with the world because we date a lot and we've been around a lot and I've been around this world for a very long time. And you know what? Sometimes I don't feel much like a foreigner or an exile. And here's the point. Until I change my mindset, until I can actually look at myself and say, you know what? I know I have a job to do in this world, but I am not really, this world isn't my home, so to speak. It's just kind of where I am. Then ultimately, I'm always going to end up with that worldly mindset. Because the moment I form attachment, the moment I am, this is my focal point, then you know what? Down the road I go. So as Peter brings us to the closing verses here of our inside, of our in not of the little verses here, this foundational here, he starts off talking about the life we live inside. He tells us to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against our soul. So in my battle to live in this world and not of this world, of being a foreigner exile, I love where Peter starts this because Peter acknowledges there is an inner battle that is going on inside of us. And here's the thing. It's never going to go away. I am going to fight this sin battle. I'm going to fight to try to have to abstain until the day they plant me back in the ground. This is a battle, not a vacation. And Peter says it's going to attack my very soul. And if you go back and you remember when we talked about the four-part person a few years ago, we talked about the idea that I am a very complicated person. I have my physical self, that thing that you see, my skin, my eyes, those stuff that you can see. I have my mental self, my brain, my mind, those things at which I think. I have my emotional self, those things which I feel that I hurt and I long for, but then there is another part of me that is deep down inside that connects me to God. It is my spiritual self, and that is my soul. And Peter says this war that's going on, it's not a physical war, not a mental battle, not a heart battle. This is a battle for soul. This is a battle for your soul. And so he tells us that we must abstain, which means restrain oneself from doing or enjoying something. The definition is accurate because you know what? I nor anyone else can make you abstain. Now, I'm good at this. I can make you feel guilty for not abstaining. I can see you doing something, and I'm good at the guilt trip thing. I can lay the guilt trip on you, and you know what? I can make you feel guilty for it, but you know what? I can't make you stop doing it. Nope. I can even hand out punishments if you don't abstain. I can say, if you do this, then I'm going to do this, and you're not going to like what I'm going to do more than the enjoyment you're going to get. And so you know what? When I hand out the punishment, maybe I can make you stop for a little while because you don't want to get punished, but in the end, it's your choice. It's your decision whether or not you're going to abstain or not. I can't make you. At some point, you're going to be out of my voice's range. You're going to be out there all on your own. And you know what? I can't make you. I can't follow you around 24/7 and make you. You're going to end up having to make your own decisions. But what are we supposed to abstain from? Peter says from sinful desires. Now, I like this because Peter does not say sin, which is action. Peter does not say, hey, look, I just want you to stop doing bad things. Wouldn't that be great if that was the solution? Just don't do bad things. That's not what Peter says. Peter says, I want you to go a little deeper. I want you to actually abstain from your sinful desires. Psalm 37:4 says, take delight in the Lord and he will give the desires of your heart. Peter and the psalmist know that if all I'm going to do is stop misbehaving, eventually I lose the battle. At some point, something's going to come up, and I'm going to say, what that's going on looks more fun than what I'm doing, and you know what? I have decided I'm not going to abstain, and I'm just going to go. And then at the end, I'm like, how did I get here? That's because sin isn't the issue as far as from an action. Sin is an issue from changing your desires. Peter says, if you're really going to kick sin out, if you're really going to deal with your sin, you can't just commit yourself, I'm going to do the right thing or I'm not going to do the wrong thing. It says your focus must be changing your desire. What I want to do on the inside has to change. And can I just tell you, 55 years old, I have been doing this church thing now 44 years. I have been fighting this battle and I have got the scars to go with it. And I just want to tell you something. This battle, it will not be easy. You're going to have your good days where you feel like you could conquer the world, and you're going to have your bad days where you end the day and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. Back and forth this battle is going to go, and you understand Peter is playing the long game here. He's telling you, you have to change your heart a little bit at a time, not just change your actions. A lot of people think if I come to church, it'll fix my problems. You start coming to church, I hate to tell you this, your problems have just started. Because God's going to get in front of you, and you're going to become really close to God's Word, and they're going to preach God's Word to you, and they're going to talk. And you're going to end up going home and saying, I got more things to deal with than I thought. And a lot of times, you know what we do? We're like, I can't deal with all this now, and we just stop. Church is not the solution. Church is like going to the doctor. The doctor doesn't heal you. The doctor diagnoses you. And then they have to go through the healing process. And that is what this is all about, living our life in the world and not of the world. And you know, it's not bad enough that Peter says, hey, you got to fix the inside. You got to get the relationship right on the inside. You got to deal with the desires of your heart. You can't just change your action. But while I am having this raging war inside of me, Peter drops the other card, and it's that part that we kind of miss. Because a lot of times I get so obsessed with dealing with my own issues, I forget there's a part B to this verse. Okay, I come here and I'm like, fix me, make me feel better, change me. Come on, help me out. I'm tired of living this way. And I can't get anything else done until you fix me. And that's not what Peter says. He says, as you are dealing with your own things, as you're fighting your own battles, he says, hey, going consecutively with that, there's a life that you have to live on the outside. That which people see. He says, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us. Again, the original sermon title was Building a Bridge. This is called Becoming the Bridge, because you know what? We've been building bridges for years. We have. We've been trying to build a bridge and look at people and say, come on across the bridge. Come on, come on. You can do it one step at a time. Come on, cross the bridge and join me on the good side. That over there is bad. And you know what? How's it working for us? You're tired of trying to escort people across the bridge, and you feel more like you're trying and dragging them across the bridge because they're just not interested? That's not what they want. They don't want you to build some mechanism for them to find God. You have to actually be willing to become the mechanism for them to see God. You actually have to be willing to not just be battling yourself. It says you have to live such good lives among the pagans. I didn't use the word pagans. That was Peter's word. I'm going the word he said. A pagan is just somebody that doesn't believe in God. And he says we are supposed to, the emphasis is not that I'm supposed to live a good life, is the location. Where am I supposed to live that life? Out there. Out there in the world, not so that I can see the world. What am I actually trying to get the world to do? Please don't say, see me. I'm trying to get the world to see Jesus. I'm actually trying to get the world to see through me, to see the fact that, you know what? You do have issues, you do have problems, but you know what? There's something about you that's just different. Live such good lives among the pagans. The focus, again, is not on living the good life. It's where you live it. If the only place you can live your good life is here on Sunday morning, you have a problem. That's not faith. That's called attendance. And Jesus was never big on attending. Every time he got a big crowd going, he'd usually do something to chase the big crowd away, and he'd just go with the people that were willing to be committed to what's going on. That was Jesus' way of dealing with it. See, you are here on purpose, for a purpose. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. I am quite sure you know these verses. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except for to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it out on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds. There's that phrase again. And glorify God in heaven. That's our purpose. To be the salt and the light, the seasoning and the light, so that people can actually see Jesus. Here's the thing that we don't like, though. Peter says that they're going to accuse you of doing wrong. See, a lot of times we think that I live a good life, and I'm living the life that Jesus wants, and I'm out there in the world, and what they're supposed to do is cheer me. Woohoo! Yay! Maybe they're supposed to give me a medal. You know, maybe it has good Christian person on the front of it, and I'm supposed to wear it. Maybe they'll build me a statue someday. After all, I'm a really good Christian person. And Peter says, that isn't how this works, folks. I want you to take your life that you're battling with, and I want you to go out there and live and do good to the world, and then the return, you know what they're going to do? Peter says, they're going to accuse you. They're going to look at you and say, what's wrong with you? That's not how this works. Remember, Jesus used the word, he said, they're actually going to hate you. Jesus says they may even want to kill you. But Peter kind of tones it down just a little bit. He says they're just going to try to convince you that you're wrong. So let me get this straight. Living in, not of the world means that I'm going to be constantly fighting a battle on the inside with my own sin. I'm going to constantly be fighting a battle on the outside with the people that are telling me I've got it all wrong. Welcome to the party. And in the middle of all of that, I'm supposed to have compassion. That sounds hard. That sounds complicated. And it is. However, you got to keep the end game in focus. And you just have to keep living it. Now, why would I do that? I mean, wouldn't it be easier just to pack it all in and let's say, Christianity is a Sunday morning thing. Put on my clothes, put on my little Jesus smile, pick up my Bible, come to church, sit in the pew, go out and live however I want. Separate my two lives, right? That would make this a whole lot easier, right? There's only one little problem. You haven't got the end game in mind yet. You see, Peter tells us that the goal of all of this is that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of that he visits us. And, well, I had to do a lot of thought for this. I'm kind of like, Peter, what are you driving at? Because Peter is absolutely talking about the day Jesus comes back, this thing that we call the second coming. He's talking about that. And you know what? He says that on that day, the pagans who were accusing us were going to glorify God. And I looked at them thinking, this makes absolutely, positively no sense, Peter. Until I understand something. You see, I'm battling my life, and sometimes it's a mess, it's a train wreck. And in the same time, I'm out there and I'm trying to live Jesus in front of everybody so that they can say, you know what, he's a train wreck, but somehow he's found grace and mercy for his train wreck. And they keep looking, and they keep looking, and they keep looking, and eventually, you know why they're praising God on the day of his return? They decided to walk across the bridge. they began to look at my life and say, something's not right with you. Because we keep knocking you down, and you're like one of those Bozo the Clown punching bags. You just get right back up. And you just keep living. And we see that you've got a host of issues, but you know what? Somehow, you just keep living. And eventually they just keep living, and then their curiosity draws them closer and closer. And I'm not pulling them across a bridge that I built. They're walking across the bridge that I have become. Because I'm rapidly and trustfully trying to observe God by abstaining from things that I should not do, the desires of my heart, and making God the desire of my heart. And at the same time, I'm sitting here trying to live out in the world inside out so that they can see my world, my life, and say, you know what? I don't know what's wrong with you, but I think that I'd like to be wrong with me also. And they walk across the bridge. And then that day that Jesus comes back, they're not going to be sitting there accusing anymore. They're going to be celebrating right beside me because I had compassion on the world, not just sorrow for myself because life is hard. So, how do I become this bridge? I mean, it can't be that simple, right? Not as hard as you think. Because it all starts with this idea of what is your worldview? And well, we must see the world as Jesus saw it. This is not an us and them battle. This is not a we've taken up a war and we're trying to conquer them. Remember, the only battle is the battle inside of me. Out there, that's not a battle. That's the opportunity. That's what we're supposed. That's where we're supposed to be salty and light. We're supposed to season it and light it in hopes that people will see the bridge and walk across the bridge. But unless I begin to see the world as Jesus saw it, this whole thing doesn't work. Because if I see the world as I see it, a lot of times I can have a really bad opinion of the world. I can get really down on it. I can read a headline and be in a grumpy mood for the rest of the week. Because this world is hard. See, in the end, I have to prioritize. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about prioritizing in the last section of these sermons this year. I have to learn to prioritize my life, and that means that sometimes what I want isn't what gets done, but what God wants is what gets done. Sometimes the things I want to do, I can't do, because you know what? If I do that, then I'm going to mess up the structure of my bridge, and I don't want to do that because I want as many people possible to walk across that bridge. So the question is that what your worldview is? Is that how you see the world? So I wear these things. They're called glasses. And if I take them off, you're not here anymore. Okay, you're here. It's just every single one of you is a big, blurry fuzzball right now. I literally could not pick out a face if my life depended on it without my glasses. Okay, somebody moved an arm. If you made a face, I can't see what you did. And I go every so often, I get these things called haircuts. It doesn't take them quite as long as they used to. It used to take them a while. Now they can do it really quick once they figure out where they're supposed to cut. And I get these things called haircuts. And to cut my hair, the barber always asks me to remove my glasses. So I take my glasses off and I sit in the chair. And you realize she could do anything she wants to at this point because I can't see a thing. And when she's all done cutting, she turns around and she has me look in the mirror. And she always does it the same way. She says, so what do you think? And I'm like, it looks wonderful. She's like, well, let me get your glasses for you first. Because she understands without my glasses, I can't see a thing. Sometimes these glasses get dirty and spotty. And actually right now they're kind of dirty and spotty. And you understand when they get dirty and spotty what I have to do if I want to clean them. If I want to use them, right? I have to clean them. I have to get up the little spray and spray them and wipe them down and get all the stuff off of it that you just get on it from living your life. You understand, we need new spiritual glasses. When we look at it, people and our world, sometimes we just see them as fuzzy blobs that we think, oh, yeah, well, I see them, but I can't really see them. Because we need some Jesus-focused glasses with compassion. And just so you know, sometimes those Jesus-focused glasses, they're going to get a few fingerprints on them. They're going to get a little dirt on them. They're going to get some smudges on them. And that is kind of what church is for. It's where you come and we help you clean your glasses so that you can see the world and go back out and be the people that you need to be. That's what we're supposed to be doing at church, is helping you clean your glasses so that you can then see the world clearly so that you can share. Boy, that's a big difference in the way we view the world a lot of times, isn't it? So what you're saying is my view of the world is supposed to be the world is actually my focus. When it comes to sharing Christ, yes. When it comes to that inner battle, you've got to focus yourself on Jesus.